talking about family, we're looking at the family tree of Jesus. And as we talk about family, let's just talk a moment about our families. My guess is some of you have some interesting people in your family. I was talking with a group of guys this week. We were kind of doing the sermon questions from last week, and we talked about interesting people in our family stories, and it was just fascinating to go around the table and hear different stories. If you've got a family historian in your family, maybe you've discovered someone who's really interesting in your past. That, you know. So, for instance, in my case, one of the most interesting people when you go back, you know, a few generations is this guy. I got to try that hairstyle, but... this is John C. Calhoun, the 7th president of the United States, but perhaps most famous or infamous for the fact that John C. Calhoun was arguably one of the most ardent defenders of slavery in the 19th century. And if you trace back part of my family tree, you hit Calhouns, and the most famous Calhoun is this guy. I don't know if they're family historians in your family, but maybe you've discovered, you know, some interesting people that are part of your background. And even if you don't have a family historian, even if there's not anyone who's really traced your family back multiple generations, undoubtedly, if we sat down and have a conversation, you could describe just some interesting things about your family, some interesting people in your family. But we also have to acknowledge this. With those interesting people, those different people, can often come some hurt and tension and division. I mean, that can be part of family dynamics. In some sense, it's part of every family, so don't feel like you're alone in this. And for some of us, some of the family tension is deep and profound hurt. And I think we have to acknowledge that at Christmas, right? I mean, Christmas is a time we come together as families, but sometimes that can be pretty awkward. For some of you, the hardest part about Christmas is navigating family events and conversations. Because you look at life maybe very differently than other people. You look at politics differently. You look at culture differently. I mean, for instance, maybe you don't get why certain people in your family are so loyal to one particular political party. You look at life and you go, you know, we've got so much choice everywhere else in our lives. I get on my phone, I can personally shape how I engage music and information and news. I get on my Amazon Prime account and I have endless choices that can all be at my home in 2 days. And yet when it comes to elections, it feels like we shrink all of the choice down to people that either have an R or a D behind their name. And you're like, can't the system be different? And why is it like the way it is? And so you get together with family, and there's this person that's strong on for this party or that party, and you just don't get it. So there's tension. And we have to acknowledge maybe you will experience some of that even going into Christmas this year. I think we just have to, you know, that can be part of our Christmas experience. But if you know tension and division, those hard moments in your family, one of the things I want to encourage you with is, you know what, you're not alone. Because as it turns out, there is tension in the very family tree of Jesus. And that really brings us back to Matthew chapter 1. It brings us back to Matthew chapter 1. And to help you understand this tension, we've got to kind of jump into the first century for a moment. So we have to go back and understand the setting of first century Palestine, the first century Israel. We have to be attuned to the fact that in the first century, Israel... Palestine has been under foreign domination, right? It's now under the rule of the Roman regime, and there's been different forms of foreign, rule and interest going back several centuries, and so there's been this ongoing influence of negative ideology and pagan religious beliefs. And not surprisingly then, for many in first century Israel, there was this deep desire, deep passion. We've got to maintain our purity. We've got to remain distinctive. Otherwise, we will lose our identity. We've got to be different from those other people. And if you read some of the Jewish texts that come from this era, from the time between the Old Testament and the New Testament, you will see this theme. For instance, there's a Jewish document where the author says, you know what? God gave us, the Jews, the law so that we would not mingle with those other people. So that we could maintain our purity, our identity. And at a popular level, where you saw this the most in the first century was arguably in the Pharisaic movement. Now, it's easy to caricature the Pharisees, but, you know, at their best, they were trying to preserve the identity, the purity of their people in the wake of such foreign influence. And so what's fascinating then is as we come to Matthew's gospel, Matthew begins, right, with the genealogy of Jesus. And to a Jew in the first century, you're easily drawn into the story because he tells the story and he begins the story with this bloodline, a bloodline that shows us Jesus is no pretender. Jesus is in the royal line of David. And you read along and you go, yes, he's one of us. This is what we've been waiting for. This is what we've been looking for. The one who comes to fulfill our promises, our Messiah. But then there's a surprise in the genealogy. And this is where the tension comes in. The tension comes in because as Matthew gives us the family tree, right, of Jesus, women are included. And that may not surprise you, but it was really shocking in the first century. Because if you were going to give someone's genealogy to establish their purity, you would do that through the men, not the women. And yet, its strategic place is here in this genealogy, right? Matthew refers to Tamar, Rahab, Ruth, and Bathsheba. And then, of course, we have reference to Mary, the mother of Jesus. And so the question becomes, why are they in the genealogy? We weren't expecting women. Why? Well, some have said, well, you know, he includes it just to show that this isn't just a story about guys, it's a story about women. And maybe that's true. But then the question is, if you're going to include women, why do you include these women? See, if I were telling the story of Israel and I were going to include women, well, what about Sarah? What about Rebecca and Rachel, right? Really kind of the heroic women in the story of Abraham and his family. Why not include those? They're not in the genealogy. It's these women. Well, someone said, well, you know, there are unusual circumstances in each of their stories that are very dramatic. And that's true. But there are also dramatic stories in the lives of other famous women in Israel. So once again, it comes back to why these women? And I think the best answer to that why question is this. These women are included because they are outsiders. Quite possibly Tamar is a Canaanite. Rahab is clearly a Canaanite. Ruth is from Moab, and Bathsheba is linked with Uriah the Hittite. And so this is masterful what Matthew is doing here. Because he's showing us, you know what, these people are part of the story as well. And so this becomes an early clue in Matthew's gospel that he's drawing us into the story of Jesus. The one who comes as the fulfillment of all these Jewish promises. But in coming to fulfill these Jewish promises, he is coming in such a way that the promises will ultimately move beyond those borders to include other ones as well. And so I think Matthew is, these are just the opening clues in the storyline of Matthew's gospel. It's going to be developed further in the course of this book. And early clues that, you know what, this is the unexpected plan of God, an unexpected plan where the Jewish Messiah comes to his people, but ultimately it's a message that's going to transform the world. And we begin with these opening clues in the genealogy, just kind of drawing us in that this isn't quite the plan we expected. And by the end of the book, we hear Jesus commissioning his disciples, right? To go into all the world, to cross racial, cultural, socioeconomic barriers and bring this message. So as it turns out, it's a very unexpected plan. And this is what Jesus is coming to fulfill. And this is what Matthew is preparing to tell us as he draws us into this a genealogy. He's setting the stage for what will come in the rest of the book. And ultimately in doing that, I think he's also speaking to those of us who are followers of Christ to say, look, if you're now part of this family, you're part of this movement that is moving outward, that is including other people. You're now part of Jesus' mission. And I think that applies to us as well. And along those lines, I just want to kind of prepare you now. In a few moments, I'm going to ask you to do a couple of bold things. And among other things, I'm going to ask you just to write down the name of someone, if you're a follower of Christ, to write down the name of someone who needs the transforming work of Jesus Christ. So even now, I'm going to be giving you a few minutes just to think about that. You know, who's the first person that comes to mind when I ask you that question? We'll get there in a moment, but before we do, let's just drill down into this genealogy and look at one person. Let's think about Rahab for a moment, right? We meet Rahab in the book of Joshua. Remember, as Joshua is leading Israel into this land that God has promised, they've already been instructed and promised, you know what, God is going to go before you. God is going to drive out these people. And so that's the expectation, that the foreigners have to be kicked out for us to be occupiers of this land and to maintain our purity. And so the plan begins to operate, and now we come up to Jericho and we send in these spies. And undoubtedly to kind of be as inconspicuous as possible, the spies decide we're going to hang out at the brothel. You know, that's kind of where outsiders hang out. And of course, Rahab is there. She's a prostitute. And it appears these spies weren't very good at what they did, because they're discovered, right? I mean, if you're really a good spy, nobody knows you, but people come looking for them. And this is where the story gets really interesting, because Rahab protects them. Rahab hides them. And it's like, well, why? Why would she do that? Why would she protect these people? And, you know, it becomes clear as you read a little further in the story, because we come to Joshua 2:9, and here's what she says. She said, you know what? I know that the Lord has given you this land and that a great fear of you has fallen on us, so that all who live in this country are melting in fear because of you. Rahab, why did you do that? Well, in some sense, out of fear, but there's already this kind of beginning step of faith that she understands God is at work here. And, you know, this had to be a surprise to Joshua because, of course, ultimately she and her family are protected. And of course, they're ultimately enfolded into the storyline of what God was doing. They become part of Israel. And I'm sure for Joshua, this was a little mind-altering, because he comes into this land thinking, we've got to get rid of all these people because we're the people of God. Only to discover in Jericho, you know what? God has actually been working here. This plan's a little more unexpected than I thought, because he's including people that I didn't anticipate. And by the time we get to Matthew's gospel, it becomes clear Rahab has become part of this story, the outsider. Now, even as we take a moment to look back, now I just want to jump forward and show you one other scene in Matthew's gospel. Turn with me to Matthew chapter 15. Matthew chapter 15. As you turn there, let me just make this observation. In reading the New Testament, it can be helpful to realize at times the writers of the New Testament, as they tell the story of Jesus, as they tell the story of the early church, at times there are ways in which they tell the story in a manner that reminds us of something that has taken place in Israel's history. And the more attuned you become to the biblical storyline, the more I think you're going to see some of these links. That, I mean, there are ways in which they tell new stories to remind us of old stories and to help us see just this is part of an ongoing plan of what God is doing. And I think when we come to Matthew 15, this is one of those places. I mean, this is very subtle. But in Matthew 15, Matthew shows us this woman coming up to Jesus. And I think in a real sense, as Matthew tells the story to the careful reader, he is saying, and by the way, do you remember Rahab the outsider, who's now in the storyline of Jesus? Do you remember her? Doesn't this woman remind you of her? Doesn't it remind you of this unexpected thing that God is doing? So let me show you the opening part of this story in Matthew chapter 15. 21 and following. Leaving that place, Jesus withdrew to the region of Tyre and Sidon, and a Canaanite woman from that vicinity came to him crying out, "Lord, Son of David, have mercy on me. My daughter is demon-possessed and suffering terribly." Now notice this. Jesus doesn't say anything. Jesus did not answer a word. So his disciples came to him and urged him, "Send her away, for she keeps crying out after us." And he answered, "I was sent only to the lost sheep of Israel." But the woman persists. She comes and she kneels before him. "Lord, help me," she said. And then he replied, "It is not right to take the children's bread and toss it to the dogs." Ouch. Now, once again, as Matthew tells this story, I think in the back of our mind, he wants us to say, "Oh, she reminds me of Rahab." And here are a couple of reasons why I think that is the case. First of all, as Matthew tells the story of Jesus, particularly in chapter 14 and 15, they're echoes of the Exodus story from the Old Testament. So, for instance, in Exodus, the waters part. In Matthew, Jesus walks on the water. In Exodus, God feeds the people in the wilderness. In Matthew, Jesus feeds the people in the wilderness. So there are certain links between Matthew 14 and 15 in these Old Testament stories. Furthermore, in Greek and Hebrew, the name Joshua and Jesus is the same term. So it would have been natural for a first century reader to draw connections between Jesus and the woman and Joshua and the woman. And third, and to me this is the most compelling link between this and the story of Rahab, third, notice how Matthew introduces us to the woman. What does he call her? She is a Canaanite. Now here's the deal. You didn't use that term in the first century. It's outdated. In a technical way, Canaanites don't exist anymore. This is why when Mark tells the same story, he refers to her as a Syrophoenician woman, to refer to her geographically. So it's like Matthew takes this out-of-date term and places it on the woman to help draw connections to the Old Testament, and I think particularly to the story of Rahab. This is the only place in the New Testament that the term Canaanite occurs. You just don't use it anymore. But I think, see, Matthew, he's kind of waking up our remembrance of the Old Testament storyline. And so we see this woman, she comes to Jesus, right? Her daughter is sick, she's demon-possessed. And it's kind of surprising, isn't it? Jesus initially says nothing. And I think in saying nothing, what happens is, as he becomes quiet, it just draws the disciples into the conversation. And notice what the disciples do. What do they say? "Send her away. Tell her to move on here." And I think what you were hearing there is that whole idea of, he's for us. This is the one who comes to fulfill our promises. This doesn't concern you. He's the Jewish Messiah, right? I mean, it's that sense of purity and distinctiveness. And this is, look, move along here, lady. This isn't about you. This is about us. So just kind of, stop causing a scene. And so the disciples kind of urge her to move on. And initially, Jesus seems to kind of confirm their viewpoint because he says, "Look, I've been sent to Israel." And then it seems to get even more awkward because, she persists and Jesus makes the statement about food at the table and, the dogs, and it seems to be very derogatory. And I mean, he just called her a dog, right? And I'm not sure I understand completely what's going on here, but I do think this is happening. I think at one level, through this rather bold statement Jesus makes to the woman, he's continuing to draw the disciples in, and at one level continuing to confirm the reality that he is the Jewish Messiah. He is the fulfillment of all of these Old Testament promises. But through that rather rude comment, I think he's also inviting her to push back on him. And that's exactly what happens. I mean, in a real sense, she wins the argument, right? Because notice what comes next. She said, "You know what? You're right about the whole table and the dog thing, but even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from their master's table." Whoa, that's a great comeback. And then Jesus said to her, "Woman, you have great faith. Your request is granted." And her daughter was healed at that moment. Wow. It's fascinating. In Matthew's gospel, there are only two people that are really commended for their faith. One is the centurion in Matthew 8, and the other is this woman in Matthew chapter 15. And they're both outsiders. And so in a real sense, Jesus kind of draws everyone into the story, but then it has that surprising twist at the end. And I think he's wanting his disciples to see, yes, guys, you're right. I've come to fulfill all these Jewish promises. I've come as the son of David. I've come in that royal line. But you need to understand that in coming in that royal line, the plan isn't exactly what you've expected. Because the plan is now going to reach out and include more and more people. It's going to cross all kinds of barriers. It's a plan for outsiders. Now, very quickly, let me just highlight a couple of implications of kind of Rahab and the story of this woman that comes out in the opening part of Matthew's gospel. I think one of the things that I come away with reading the genealogy of Jesus and then seeing the links with the story of this woman is this. I think we need to realize how we fit into Jesus' family tree. Let me ask you a question. You ever been in those situations where you felt like you were left out? You know the situation, you're in a conversation with a group of people and somebody tells an inside joke and you don't get it? Maybe you know situations where, you know, certain groups of people got together but they didn't include you. There was this project at work but you were left out. You know, there's this peer group at school but you never got to be a part of it. Do you know that feeling of being on the outside looking in? Here's the deal. I mean, I come to this genealogy of Jesus and I start to understand this tension. And it forces me to acknowledge as a non-Jew. You know, there once was a time when people thought that when God fulfilled his promises, it wouldn't include people like me. Whether I realize it or not, there really was a time when people like me, we were on the outside looking in. And I think we need to let that sink in if we're followers of Christ, because that entails most of us as non-Jews. And so as we come to celebrate the birth of Christ and the work of Christ, we're coming to celebrate that reality where we now get to be brought in. We no longer have to be stuck as outsiders. We've been enfolded into this ongoing story. But I think as you start to understand that, it will also help you understand this. We need to understand that you don't have the Messiah without his mission. See, part of what Matthew is doing, I think, in giving us these opening clues that this plan of God is going to include outsiders, this plan of God is going to continue to involve more and more people. Part of what he is doing is saying this: look, if you are a follower of Christ, you are now, you're part of this ongoing story. And we need to understand at Christmas, the story we celebrate is also a story that draws us in. I think that's part of what Matthew is wanting us to see. We're drawn into this story. Even if in some sense we were on the outside looking in, we're being drawn into this story. Along those lines, I can't help but think about Peter. You know, Peter would have been one of those guys standing by Jesus when this woman is standing in front of them going, you know, she just needs to move on. This isn't for her. This is our stuff. It doesn't involve her. He didn't fully understand the nature of God's unexpected plan. And it would be several years later as he continues to, you know, see and understand, as he gets past the reality of the resurrection and all that entails, that Peter would be the guy who's able to stand before other Jews who had become Christians and say, you know what, I now get this plan. It's moving beyond us. It's crossing borders. It's moving into unexpected places. And we get to be a part of that. So if you're a follower of Christ, you need to understand you really don't. This Messiah you celebrate, you don't get the Messiah without also being drawn into his mission. The story you celebrate is a story that is drawing you in, whether you realize it or not. So let's ask the question, well, then what does that look like for us? What does it look like to be drawn into the story? Well, I think, among other things, it's just being attuned to your sphere of influence and the people around you. To be willing to pray for them and their needs, but also pray that God would draw them to himself. And even as you pray that way, to be open to kind of ways God gives you to live out your faith in your different relationships. And even at times, as conversations unfold, to perhaps share your story or just explain what being a follower of Christ means to you and what it looks like. Being willing just to say, if you ever have any questions about it, I'd be glad to tell you more. Being willing to engage those conversations. Because see, this story we're celebrating this season is a story that is drawing you in as a follower to be part of his mission. So with that in mind, I'm going to ask you to do a couple of bold things this morning. We're going to do something just a little different this morning. As you came in, you may have noticed there are tables in the back and there are tables at the front. And on each of these tables, they're magnets that look like this. They have a white side. We've also got Sharpie pens on each of the tables because you need to have a Sharpie to write on this magnet. And here are the two bold things I'm going to ask you to do. In a moment, I'm just going to ask you to get up and move to, you know, whichever table is closest to you, whether that be at the back or the front. And I'm going to ask you to kind of write down the name of a person in your life that really needs the work of Jesus Christ. Now, if you want, you can just write down like a first name or even initials or, you know, my neighbor, coworker, or something like that, however you want to do that. And perhaps it'll be, you know, you can, if you want, you can kind of gather around the table and pass around a marker, and once you've written it, you can go back to your seat, go back to where you're sitting. And then here's the other bold thing I'm going to ask you to do. In the areas where you're sitting, I'm going to ask you to exchange this magnet with someone around you. And once again, I realize that's a bold thing, but I think this is important because, see, the deal is we're in this together. We're in this mission of Christ together. And we're going to exchange them for this reason. In fact, you know, see, even the first service I exchanged with someone else, and now I've got his magnet. And so the deal is this magnet can go on my refrigerator at home just as a reminder, particularly during the Christmas season, to pray for this individual. And wouldn't it be an encouragement to you to know that even as you think about someone in your life, maybe it's a family member, maybe it's a coworker, a fellow student at school, as you think about, wouldn't it encourage you to know somebody else is praying for that person as well? Perhaps at some point this is going to lead to further conversations with the people that you exchange with. And I realize you may just be even introducing yourself to this person, and you don't have to give a lot of information. It's just, hey, would you pray for my neighbor? But I think it's valuable and significant that we do this. Because you see, as we celebrate the Messiah, he is the Messiah that brings us into his mission. So I'm going to invite you to one of these tables to write your name, go back, exchange it with someone else. And then in a couple of moments, I'm going to come back and just kind of close this time of the service in prayer. So I'm going to invite you to do that right now.
Hey.